listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in Roquetas de Mar.
This is some jaunty old music, Daniel.
This is the welcome to the best bit of the podcast, the best bit of the Witchcraft podcast.
Oh my word, we're going to have to get a jingle made up for that. I'm Lionel Burney. This is a cycling podcast from the Vuelta a España. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Lionel.
And we are in Roquetas de Mar. Roquetas by sea, I guess.
Roquetas, not croquetas, Lionel. Croquetas. I bet you've had a lot of croquetas. Who doesn't have a lot of croquetas when they're in Spain? It's very, very much a staple, regardless of region, it seems.
Yeah, I do like them. They're nice. The other day, at lunch, I had a selection. There were some chicken ones, some shrimp ones, some black pudding ones, some cheese ones. And these are the kind of potato, well, they're croquettes, aren't they? I mean, cakes, potato yeah. cakes with a filling, deep fried. I must admit, I'm finding the cuisine down here, it's all quite beige, isn't it? They're not really...
The regional identity of places, well, I find you have to go quite a long way or have to go to some lengths to find places that are offering really distinct regional specialities. There tend to be a lot of those staples that everyone knows, the tortilla, the croquetas, and then the meats, big steaks or cod and chips, a lot of chips.
I wonder, I might ask Fran this later, whether the chips, is that a British... import, because so many British holiday makers will have come down to this part of Spain from, I guess, the tourism here kicked off in around about the mid-60s. That was a bit of a hospital pass, wasn't it, Daniel? Have you not done any research on the historical tourism links between Spain and Britain?
This feels like a question we should be putting to Luis Ángel Mate, the Lynx of Marbella, who should be our go-to man on issues such as these. Just on completely nonsensical tangents, Lionel, one thing I neglected to mention yesterday, but I feel like I should mention, for purely self-indulgent reasons, in our car on this bus, we're playing a great game, Decathlon versus Osborne Bull. Do you know what an Osborne Bull is? Mm-hmm. So the Osborne Bull, the silhouette of the bull that used to advertise the Osborne. It's kind of a vermouth, isn't it? Anyway, you see them all over Spain, but particularly in Andalusia, and they're a bit of an icon of the Vuelta. We set ourselves a challenge in our car to spot as many Osborne bulls as possible and spot as many branches of Decathlon. And at the moment, it's 2-2, but the Decathlons are going to increase in number when we go up north. The Osborne Bulls are going to decrease in number. So Decathlon, I think, are going to have a strong second half of the Vuelta. Why I mentioned that, I do not know. Pure self-indulgence, as I say.
Interesting. In my car, I'm playing a game of how do I idle away the hours driving, because nothing works in my car. The radio doesn't work. The phone won't link up. The sat-nav's been disabled. It's just me and my thoughts, which is pretty terrifying. I know you're wincing. But Daniel, we're on the outskirts of town here. I'm actually staying here tonight down by the coast, and it's a bit scrappy around here, isn't it? The race came in a funny old way into town. You mentioned the Osborne Bulls there advertising a drink, very popular. What, in fact, one of those bulls featured in the illustration for our first Kilometre Zero episode of the Vuelta, which was called Vuelta Vignettes, which was released on Monday. And someone made the point, lovely illustration by Grand Tour Art, but when I see that bull there in the background, they're big billboards, aren't they? But when I see that bull, I just think of the appalling treatment that the bulls are met with in some parts of Spain. And obviously, well, bullfighting's still pretty popular in some parts of Spain. Not sure whether it's something that's popular down here in Andalusia, is it?
Well, it is, Lionel. A couple of days ago, the race went past Ronda, one of the most beautiful towns in Andalusia, but also the birthplace of modern bullfighting, I understand. When I see those Osborne bull billboards, I think the buffalo.
Yeah, a big silhouette of the buffalo looming over us from the Andalusian hillsides.
Very apt indeed.
If you're listening, buffalo, which you obviously are, send us a text when you get to this bit. Anyway, we should talk about the stage five of the Vuelta a España from Granada this morning. Didn't manage to get up close to the football stadium, unfortunately. The town was pretty busy this morning and all the road closures for the race, because they did a big, like, 20-minute circuit of the city before the flag went down and the race was underway. The neutralised section was seemed excessively long, but I suppose they wanted to take the riders through the whole of the city, or maybe they were just trying to avoid the ring road or something to get them out of town. Not quite sure. And then it was a real lumpy old day all the way down here to the coast, and there was a big break, and the big break got a big lead, and really the Vuelta, well, it's all changed because the red jersey has swapped shoulders. Team Sky put up a kind of half-hearted defence of the red jersey. Mikhail Kwiatkowski is now behind Rudy Mollard, French rider with the Groupama FDJ team. The race for the stage itself really boiled down into two groups of three. The front trio were Simon Clark of EF Education First, Bauke Mollema of Trek Segafredo, and Alessandro De Marchi of BMC Racing, and they were ahead of Davide Villela of Astana, Rudy Mollard of Groupama, and Floris Dutier of Lotto NL Jumbo. Mollard was riding like a man with four legs to try and get that red jersey, and he is in the lead now by 31 seconds, and the stage came down to a real cagey old sprint in the end, and Simon Clark won for EF Education First. Now, yesterday, Ben King won for Dimension Data. That was their first World Tour win of the season, and it left EF Education First as the only team without a World Tour win this season. Well, they've corrected that today. So now, everyone's won at least one World Tour race from the World Tour teams, and a much-needed win for Education First today.
Yes, absolutely, Lionel. And Simon Clark said in his press conference that he feels the results this year have not reflected the level of performance and the level of rider they have in that team. But it's been a rough campaign, reminiscent of, was it 2016, where they didn't win a World Tour race? And in fact, most of 2015, they hadn't won a World Tour race, had they? And it's a team that really needs to rediscover the knack of particularly finishing breakaways. Yesterday, we saw a very sort of EF education-y scenario with Pierre Roland being in a very good position and not able to finish things off, understandably, because he was very much a marked man yesterday and it was pretty tough for him. But Clark did the opposite today, rode a very canny race. It was very interesting actually to listen to the way he sort of selected his breakaway companions. He was very conscious of the need to go away with guys who had teammates in the group further back, teammates who would be able to disrupt the chase. So that was Brent Buchwalter for De Marchi and Brambilla for Mollemar, and that certainly was a factor in that group being able to stay away.
You mentioned Simon Clark's press conference. We've just come out of that, and he spoke unbroken for about 7 minutes, explaining his strategy and how he was feeling on the climbs. And he said everyone was very tired on the climbs. At the end of his 7-minute soliloquy, he got a little round of applause, which was a kind of ironic round of applause, because the Spanish woman who sitting alongside Simon Clark, ready to translate for the Spanish media, probably had about 1,500 or 2,000 words to go through in order to convey accurately in Spanish what Simon Clark had said very, very eloquently in Aussie English.
I think he broke the record, the Grand Tour record, for longest ever answer in a press conference set by Filippo Pozzato in the stage. Where did it finish, Lionel? We were in Burgundy in 2007. He won quite a big bunch sprint, and I think his answer that day's monologue was about 7 minutes long.
Almost as long as the tail of the Etapa on some days. What about Rudy Mollard in the red jersey and Team Sky's chase? Conflicting kind of opinions on whether or not Sky were trying to keep Kwiatkowski in red or not. What's your take?
I was made to look like a bit of an idiot, not for the first time, at the finish when I put it to Theo Gegenhart, friend of the podcast, gap year student extraordinaire, that it looked as though Sky had decided they might want to keep the jersey. They were certainly on the front a lot, There was no obvious sitting up and letting the break go to 10, 15 minutes, bearing in mind that Rudy Mollard is not someone who would pose a threat on general classification, even if he gained 10 minutes, I don't think. He's not a bad climber by any stretch of your imagination, but he's got no real credentials as a Grand Tour GC rider. So they were on the front, and they were certainly holding the gap pretty well, and at times it was coming down relatively quickly, and then they rode on the front into the finish. So it looked to me at times as though they were trying to defend the jersey, and also I think it perhaps would have, well, if it had been any other team, it would have made sense for them to keep the jersey, because I don't think Michał Kwiatkowski is going to win the Vuelta. I don't necessarily think he's going to finish in the top 5, 6, 7. So the next few days, well, for any other team, keeping the red jersey would have been a very worthy goal to pursue, and the fact that they didn't do it, I don't know, what does that suggest? That they feel that Kwiatkowski is going to get it back at La Covatilla? Do they feel they've got bigger fish to fry, maybe with Kwiatkowski or another rider later on? I'm not sure.
From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Now, last year, Richard accused me of treating the Vuelta like the holiday grand tour. Nothing could be further from the truth this year. I'm working extremely hard, even if I did own up to having a small siesta during yesterday afternoon stage. But it's that time of year when people's thoughts start turning to then following year and where to go on holiday. And if cycling holidays are your thing, then Rafa Travel may very well have the perfect escape for you. The choice of holidays that Rafa Travel are now offering is pretty extensive. Lots of destinations in Europe and much further afield, including Patagonia, which of course sort of straddles Argentina and Chile. I hope I've got that right off the top of my head. There's breaks for very keen cyclists all over the globe. Check out rafa.cc/travel and you can have a browse through all of those trips, and maybe one will suit you. Daniel, Rudy Mollard, Fran told me earlier today, and you, I think you asked Rudy Mollard about this, when 10 years ago he was junior world winter time trial world winter triathlon champion. Now I had to look up what a winter triathlon is, but it appears to be mountain biking, running and cross-country skiing.
Yeah, and he seemed very proud of this fact. Rightly so, Lionel. I'm sure you'd be proud of such a distinction if you'd been the world junior winter triathlon champion. Alas,
I thought something else was coming there, where you were going to start running through what my ideal triathlon would be, but we'll leave that to the listeners, I think.
He's a rider who has got better and better over the last few years. He's quite a punchy little climber, as I said earlier. He's not someone with great pedigree as far as the general classification is concerned. Interesting to see how Groupama FDJ approach it over the next few days, because they've obviously got goals here with Thibaut Pinot, and they haven't necessarily got the most experienced team to support Pinot. The heat has been difficult for everyone in these first few stages, and I think that was perhaps one reason for Sky not busting a gut to keep the jersey today. But will FDJ follow suit? They'll be helped certainly in the next few days by the sprinters teams. There are three obvious opportunities now for sprinters, and there are a lot of sprinters who have so far got nothing from this Vuelta, who will do a lot of the work, but still they'll have to burn some matches, I think.
It's notable, isn't it? We often talk during the Tour de France about how teams no longer have the luxury of any kind of divided focus. They either are concentrating on one thing or another, and we've seen this year with the eight-man teams that is even more pronounced than usual. But Simon Clark was making the point today that he was really excused his regular duties, because he is the man who looks after Rigoberto Urán. Had a very difficult Tour de France, because the first week protecting Iran was challenging enough. And then, of course, they had to look after Iran for a day in the mountains when he was really struggling after his crash on the cobbles. And obviously the disappointment of Iran then pulling out, and they kind of resolved then to have a much better Vuelta. Clark had ringed this stage and stage seven as potential opportunities for him. And this morning, or last night, when he talked to the team sports director, Juan Manuel Garate, basically seeking permission to be let off the leash today. At the finish, I spoke to Garate about their tactics today and also about the importance of EF education first, finally getting a World Tour win this season.
Yeah, I mean, today was a clear... Yesterday, on paper, was not a stage for a breakaway for me. It was more a kind of a GC stage, but at the end the break made it. And today was clearly a stage for the break, and we put some energy, especially with Simon. Since this morning we spoke, and he was the only one of us that he could be in that break and had chances to win. And so we put a lot of energy on him, and Tom Van Asbroek helping a little bit to be in that break. But he did a really great job today. It was a really hard day, hard parkour, and he made it.
But once he got into the break, that's only the first part of the job, isn't it? It was a big group. So how did you go about making sure that when the selection happened, Simon was always in the right place?
You need to be always in the race. You need to be, when it's a big group like this, 25 riders, you cannot wait. You need to, if you anticipate, you have more chances. For sure, the break is going to explode far behind from the finish line. And year by year, it's exploding even farther from the finish line every break. And this is something that we know. So we try every time to anticipate that moves. And sometimes it doesn't work, but in this case, it was a good move.
And when it came to the finish and you knew that Clark was in with Mollema and in with DeMarchi, and DeMarchi was struggling a little bit, were you very confident, or was there still a doubt?
I mean, I was in the second car, first car, obviously behind the bunch, but we knew that on paper he was the fastest. He was the fastest, and the only thing that, you know, in a break of three, you are scared that one of them, they attack, they anticipate, and then you don't have chances. But he knows how to do these finals, and he did it, and it was good.
The other advantage when you've got somebody going for the stage win is it gives Rigoberto Urán a nice calm day where he can just be in the bunch, and also gives the whole team some confidence. Everyone's coming back to the bus now smiling and happy.
Yeah, it's exactly what's exactly our goal. I mean, Simon is a guy, is the reference for Rigo. Rigo is following all the time Simon, but in this case we let Simon free because I know that I have a powerful team, and I had another guy's church with in charge of the role that Simon had the previous days. So it's a kind of a multitask team, and we did it, and good. Now I want to say thank you to all my riders that are coming. 1 second.
So Simon Clark will be back looking after Rigoberto Urán in the coming days. And of course, Urán still a very good shout for a top five overall here at the Vuelta. Now, Daniel, you've got to get on the road because I think you're driving all the way up to the start town for tomorrow's stage, whereas I'm staying here and doing that drive in the morning. But a little bit of news about Mark Cavendish today.
Yeah, Mark Cavendish has been diagnosed for the second time in 2 years with Epstein-Barr virus. It's not clear whether, it could well be the same virus that never cleared his system. And there wasn't too much information in the press release that Dimension Data put out. I think one thing we can probably ascertain from the press release is that Cavendish's season might be over. I think his career with Dimension Data might be over. He is out of contract, and there hasn't been any talk in the last few weeks about a renewal. I understand that there won't be a renewal, so that leaves him looking for a team. And obviously over the last few months there've been various teams interested in signing him, sounded him out, but with his health as it is, and I think a pretty uncertain prognosis as far as when he's going to be ready and fit again, it complicates matters slightly. Obviously with the transfer market being quite well advanced as well, there aren't that many spots available, and certainly not when Cavendish, as we've seen his last couple of moves, he's usually brought people with him. I think there are a couple of riders whose futures will be tied to his, Bernie Eisel being one of them. So yeah, tricky for him, and it's been a tricky couple of years for him, hasn't he? I mean, he hasn't finished a Grand Tour since 2016. Ooh. And but he, I mean, I spoke to him a few days ago, and any notion that he might even think about retiring are well wide of the mark. He's thinking very much about the Tour de France next year. He's thinking very much about the Olympics in 2020. So he's certainly determined to come back stronger, and he also thinks that if he doesn't race again this season, then what he will be able to do is start his winter preparation really early and be absolutely flying when the start of next season comes around. That's what he hopes anyway.
If he rides the Olympics in Tokyo in a couple of years' time, Daniel, you're going to have to brush up on indoor cycling again. That's devastating news for you. Anyway, you'd better get on the road, and I'll catch up with you again tomorrow.
Thanks, Lionel.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Beta Fuel, the new superfuel from Science in Sport, is a 2-to-1 maltodextrin to fructose isotonic drink that delivers 80 grams of carbohydrates per serving without upsetting your stomach. This formulation means your stomach can process more carbohydrates per hour than glucose alone would allow. And this could make all the difference to your ride, whether you're cresting the Alpe d'Huez or just crossing the line at your local sportive. Available on scienceinsport.com from July the 12th.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
I'm now joined by Fran Reyes, the king of Spanish cycling. Before we resume talking about Stage 5 of the Vuelta, a reminder that you can get 25% off all Science in Sport products. The code is SISCP25, and if you enter that in the little discount code box when you go to the checkout, you'll get 25% off your order. Now, Fran, it's been very warm again here today. You're Spanish and you live down here, and even you're finding the heat a bit much, and standing out in it is hard work. I've been going through water like you wouldn't believe today, and I'm starting to think that perhaps I should have brought some electrolyte drinks from Science in Sport with me, because I think I'm losing nutrients at an alarming rate here.
You know, I was very disappointed with your performance yesterday at dinner, because I was expecting you to have a full dish of broken eggs, and you didn't even manage to eat half. No wonder you need more nutrition, Lionel.
It was very nice. It was fried eggs, chips, and Spanish ham, all broken up, as you say. But it was quite a heavy dish for a very warm evening. I mean, I normally don't struggle with a heavy dish on a warm evening, but I'm obviously not in peak form here at this Vuelta. But the heat is certainly taking its toll on the riders, and it's probably making a few of them think twice about whether or not they want to get into the breaks, because today was an extremely hard day out for everybody. What did you make of the way the race formed and how it broke up on the climbs?
Well, it was quite interesting to speak with the riders after the stage and find out how the breakaway was created. Because, of course, for the 31st kilometers, it was rolling from Granada into the Alpujarras, quite a comfortable road. Everyone who has come for training here knows it and know that it's not a difficult chunk, a difficult section. It's pretty easy to go in the pack there. It was when they made it to the Alpujarras, beginning from the town of Lanjaron, famous for its mineral water. You can find Lanjaron anywhere in Spain. That we entered in 100 kilometers that are really difficult, because they are lumpy. You can never find a rhythm, because it's always up and down on the uphill sections have respectable gradients, not the ones you would do with the big ring. So knowing this, most riders kept their best shots, their best attacks for this terrain where it was easier or more feasible to get away. And by its part, Team Sky decided to control it, especially in the category 3 climb to Orhiva, which is 4 kilometers with a quite steady 8% gradient, where a very powerful breakaway could form if the peloton was not at a high pace. So it was Sky to set the tempo. They slimmed down the peloton to 70 riders even. And after that, after they made sure no one got away in a powerful break like Nibali or some other rider that tried to make it there, they loosened the leash a bit, and it was then that the 25 rider breakaway made it. But even those 25 riders, not all of them made it to the finish. Some of them got dropped because they couldn't keep the pace, and some others, like Matteo Trentin, chose not to keep themselves in the breakaway because they felt it was going to be too much effort for nothing.
Well, you spoke to Matteo Trentin of Mitchelton Scott, the European road race champion, of course, at the finish. Let's hear what he said, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we come back.
So tell me, how hard it was to make it into a breakaway today?
It was really hard, because it was beginning on with some downhill, then on the climb we went really hard, and I think it was only 60 guys in the front. And then it was again attacking. The breakaway was gone, I was in, but at the end was too many climbers, and even the stage was harder than we expected.
Yeah, so you didn't think that it was to be that hard, that lumpy, the terrain?
Oh, it's the Vuelta, so sprinter stages like this. But today was not for the sprinter, it was really too hard at the end.
Interesting that. I mean, this does happen from time to time. A rider will get work to get into a break and then think, nah, this is not going to work out for me here. I may as well save myself for another day. And I suppose common sense told him that, because the next 3 days, I know the road book is so misleading here. I looked at the road book, and you would think the next 3 days are good chances for sprinters, but there's still quite a lot of climbing to be done.
Yeah, I mean, as for today, I would say the road to book wasn't that misleading. I mean, when I was thinking about the stage before it started, I thought there was a pretty good chance that the big bunch would make it to the finish line together, like a 100-man bunch, because of course there was lumpy terrain, but the final 50 kilometers weren't that difficult. You know, they were easy for a peloton to roll in and reel in the breakaways. But for the next 3 days, the terrain is much more kind, much more gentle for the riders. Tomorrow, the way to Murcia, there might be wind, but not much. Pozo Alcón, the last 30-40 kilometers are quite difficult, but the rest, the beginning of the stage, is not that much. Whereas the run into Almaden, we can consider that easy. Off the record, I think, because I don't think it was recorded, Matteo Trentin told me that when he got dropped, it was basically thinking of the next three stages, because those were three very good shots for a fast rider like him.
So it could well be the likes of Trentin, Elia Viviani, and the riders that we consider to be proper sprinters over the next 3 days.
Yeah, basically it will be that. I mean, it's pretty interesting to see how in this Vuelta and in the previous editions, this first week is full of stages that are devoted to breakaway specialists. You know, whereas in the Tour de France, it's nearly impossible to see a breakaway triumph in the first week. And in the Giro d'Italia, there is usually so much tension that it's also the case in the Vuelta. The relative weakness of the teams provokes that a nice breakaway with good numbers has a very good chance of making it to the finish. Last year, for example, we saw Lutsenko winning, Matteo Trentin winning for a breakaway in Murcia. And in this year, we already got Dimension Data and EF Education first getting their first World Tour of their season, victory of the season.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at the strength of the riders in that break, it's no real surprise that the riders that you would have picked, Mollema, DeMarchi, Villela, I know he was in the second group, Simon Clark, you know, the strongest riders did come to the fore when it really mattered. But Simon Clark made the point in his press conference, didn't he, that how difficult it was on the climbs and how, you know, there wasn't any attacking on the final climb because, well, they were basically cooked and it was always going to come down to a sprint after the descent.
I would say grilled lateral rather than cooked, because believe me, for those first 150 kilometers there was not a section of road with decent shade. You know, they were exposed to the sun during the whole day.
Well, that is why this whole area is absolutely dominated by greenhouses. I was quite staggered coming off the motorway and heading down to the town here for many, many kilometres, probably 10 kilometres more. You can see all the way across the sort of the hills, and all the greenhouses are there, all growing the tomatoes that we will be, if you have tomatoes imported from Spain back in the UK, they come from here, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, not only tomatoes, but a handful of vegetables whose name I don't know in English.
Describe the vegetables.
Yeah, well, they are red and round and...
Well, that's tomatoes, and tomatoes are a fruit as well. So,
well, you know... Don't give me a hard time, man. I am not a native English speaker, you know.
So what else would there be? Cucumber? No.
Yeah, for example, cucumber, yeah, and pickle, no, not pickle.
Courgettes.
Courgettes aussi, oui.
Zucchini is the name in America, so yeah, courgettes I think would come from here. Yeah. Anything that needs a nice warm climate through, because I guess they grow all through the winter as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's worth mentioning that we came from the start to the finish, not from the same road as the riders, but from a different one, closer to the coast. The coast of Almería is more or less flat. The western part of the coast is more or less flat. From Adra to Roquetas de Mar, it's more or less 30 kilometers of a coast, which is flat 7, 8, 10 kilometers inland. That's a lot of square kilometers to fill up with greenhouses. Back in the day, all this terrain was full of vines, because there was a huge wine production here in Almería. But 30 years ago, when Spain joined the European Union, there was some kind of planning that decided that it was good to take the vines away and begin creating these greenhouses where you can get maybe 3-4 seasons of vegetables per year. And of course, that way we begin the greenhouse of Europe. And it's a shame, because now we have this, in my opinion, sad reality from the point of view of the landscape especially, but also from the point of view of nature, which is a sea of plastic in front of the Mediterranean Sea. You know, that's a tragedy from an ecological standpoint, and it's also quite refreshing to see the contrast with the Alpujarra, which is more or less the region the riders went through, where there are not that many greenhouses, if any. There is still a huge tradition of production of hemp because of the heat and the air. It's a good place to do that. And well, it's more or less the part of Almería that remains virgin compared to the western coast, which is full of greenhouses, and the eastern coast, which is basically hotels and tourism.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so they can make more money per square meter from the greenhouses than they can from the vineyards. But of course, you're right. Vineyards look very attractive, and the greenhouses, well, they're not the prettiest, are they? But obviously, this part of the coast doesn't seem to be as touristy as the where we've come from. With all of the resorts. But I guess as we go around the corner, the landscape and the kind of the way the people make their money will change again, because then round the corner there's another Costa that's popular with holidaymakers, I guess. Is tomorrow Alejandro Valverde home soil.
Exactly. Yeah, tomorrow we make the way into Murcia and make it to San Javier, which is basically the Mar Menor. We will tell the story of the Mar Menor tomorrow, because that's also another ecological tragedy that has happened in the last 30 years. But yeah, more or less we can say that we go into Valverde territory. During the summer, those are his training roads.
So he will get a great reception tomorrow, and he'll be, will he mix it in the sprint, do you think?
Nah, no way. I mean, he knows what he wants to do. I mean, in the stage to Alfaguara, I suspected he wanted to get the red jersey in order to enter Murcia on it, wearing it, but he didn't manage. So tomorrow he will just enjoy the greetings from his fellow Murcians.
Don't forget to listen to our morning show, Kilometer Zero, supported by The Economist. Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings throughout the Vuelta a España.
We released the second of our 9 Kilometer Zero episodes from the Vuelta a España this morning, sponsored and supported by The Economist. Thank you very much to The Economist for enabling us to provide these episodes to all of our listeners for free. Today's episode is about Sean Kelly and his 1988 Vuelta win and the mystery of the missing trophy. It's online in all normal places now, and there will be episode 3 of Kilometer Zero on Friday morning, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that tomorrow. While I'm doing a few plugs and so on, if you'd like to come and see us live, we've got 2 live events in November that are already on sale, and tickets are selling very well indeed. We're at the Clapham Grand in South London on November the 12th, and we are in Cardiff at St David's Hall on November the 27th. Tickets are available by going to thecyclingpodcast.com and clicking on live events. We've also got our book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, which tells the story of the 2017 season, a very fine diary from Fran on one of the weeks at the Vuelta a España that book.
Also a picture of me getting changed, my trousers, so if you want to see my fine legs, they are in there too.
Don't let that put you off. And if that has put you off, maybe you want to download the audiobook version, which does not have any photographs of Fran's legs in. But Fran, did you read your chapter, or did we get an actor to do your chapter?
You got an actor, probably, because I never read my chapter, not even after writing it down. So.
This is amazing. We all had to read our own chapters, but you have a somebody else to do that for you. So it's not the voice of Fran Reyes in our audiobook, but it is his work, and that is available on iTunes and Audible and wherever else audiobooks come from. I should probably know a bit more about where audiobooks come from, but I just press a button on my phone and they download. I mean, it's as simple as that. Now, yesterday, Ben King got Dimension Data off the mark with their first World Tour win of the season. That kind of inspired EF Education First to do the same today. Those teams have had a pretty barren year, certainly in terms of wins this season. And we were talking yesterday about riders whose name is King. Reyes, of course, is the Spanish equivalent. Somebody has suggested that if you take the umlauts off Stefan Kung, that means King in Swedish. But Kung is Swiss, so I don't know whether that counts as one of our kings.
Sweden, Switzerland, more or less the same.
Oh, come on, they're a long way apart. They're a long way apart and very distinct countries. But who else? Any other kings?
Yeah, I mean, we got also Peter Koning for one of the listeners, currently racing for Rompot, if I'm not mistaken. And another friend of the podcast, James Emmett from Leaders in Sport, suggested me Wang Meiyin, the Chinese rider for Barry Merida, because of course, as you know, Lionel, Wang in Chinese means king. So yeah, another fine addition to our long list of kings of cycling.
And of course, Sean Kelly, the subject of our Kilometre Zero, was nicknamed the King. This morning I went and waited outside the Dimension Data bus for Ben King. He was obviously absolutely delighted yesterday, and he was still smiling this morning. And you could tell that the relief of bagging a big win was not just a matter of great personal pride, but it shone throughout the whole team. So this was Ben King talking this morning in Granada. Ben, has it sunk in?
It's sinking in. It's pretty overwhelming.
Obviously, you were delighted yesterday. It was a big day out, wasn't it? And when the break got so much time, what point did you realise that you were going to be able to go for the stage?
About 40k to go, I started thinking, okay, now we're going to be playing for the win. As we got closer to the climb, the break got a bit less organized. And so I started kind of just pulling through and having a gap. And so I punched out a couple times near the bottom, and that's how we ended up getting our gap after the intermediate sprint there.
What were you thinking with Pierre Hollande in the group and perhaps the obvious biggest threat?
Both Pierre and Mate were the two most dangerous riders in the breakaway, I thought. Also Stalnoff. I had my eye on him more than the other guys, I think, because Pierre and Mate had been in the breakaway the last 2 days prior. And I knew that that would have an effect on them. But Mate flew over the first KOM. Yeah, I wasn't really sure how I was going to stack up with those guys. Pierre's obviously a rider with tons of class. We're teammates in the past, so I know his capabilities well, and I certainly did not underestimate him.
You were the virtual red jersey for quite a lot of the day. Did it simplify things when you knew that that wasn't on?
Yeah, I always made that a secondary goal because I think Stalnoff wanted me to do more of the work for the overall classification, but that was never really my objective. A stage win means a lot more to me. So I kind of played that card and just said, like, look, I'm not in this for the overall. I'm not gonna give you the stage to have a chance for the overall. So I did most of the work for the majority of the climb, and then in the last 2 kilometers, I started to kind of force him on the front a bit more, and I forced him to lead the last kilometer out, and just took a few deep breaths and had confidence in my sprint. It's something that I've been working on really hard, finishing power to, you know, I've been in this kind of situations before, and just don't want to leave anything up to chance.
Whenever I see a rider playing with his shoes in the final like you were a couple of times, I think either very confident or very nervous. Which was it?
I had loosened my shoes because in the heat like this, your feet swell, and then you can get to these painful hot spots. So just to give my feet some breathing room, but for the sprint, I wanted to have like full contact, full explosive delivery to the pedals. So I ratcheted them down, but I was absolutely nervous. It's something that I've been dreaming about for a long time. And yeah, it's a terrible feeling to get really close and oh, I don't know how I'd be feeling right now if I hadn't been able to get that victory.
We often give teams a hard time when they go such a long time without a win, and we've criticised Dimension Data because, you know, Mark Cavendish has had a very bad time of it this season. And really, when a team is so clearly built around one rider or has such a clear goal, and I think you can say the same with EF Education First, you know, everything for Rigoberto Urán's overall chances at the Tour de France, and rightly so, because he finished second last year. They would have been mad not to build the whole team around Urán, and to an extent they've done the same here, but it can't be good for morale when a team goes so long without a victory. And as Ben King says, you know, once the slump sets in, it can be hard to get out again.
Yeah, I mean, the World Tour is such a vast reality, such a vast diversity of cycling teams, and basically the big difference, in my opinion, is the possibility of having not only one, but several leaders, several chances of having real good victories, especially at a World Tour level. And we see that there are several World Tour teams that maybe because of their budget, maybe because of bad luck, maybe because of bad choices are at the bottom of the standings quite often, you know, namely Dimension Data, EF Education First, Katusha, Alpothing, you know, maybe because any of these reasons, they struggle to find the result, you know, and in the case of Dimension Data and EF Education First, it took as long as until this Vuelta to get their first World Tour victory. That's harsh, that's difficult to manage, but after all, there are still very good riders in there, you know, and there are still ideas and there are still possibilities to get those victories and get and lift a bit the morale, which, as you say, it's a pretty important aspect of these streaks of no winning.
Yeah, and when you consider, you know, Quickstep, I think have got 31 World Tour wins, but they have a couple of sprinters who can take 3-4 wins here and there. And if you haven't got one of those sprinters, suddenly your top five positions, yeah, they don't. You know, you can have a string of top four or five placings, but they don't equal a win, do they? Nobody looks at it in that way. They don't say, oh, well, they've been up there close but not quite winning. People just focus on, did you win or did you not win? And it's as simple as that. It's very black and white when it comes down to the evaluation.
Yeah, in the case of Quickstep, and I think that's a pretty good example of how some World Tour teams are run, they... key to their success is not only the recruitment or young talents, which is clearly key, but also the way they keep their domestiques, their key domestiques, year after year. They manage to find the right people to bring the star riders to the line, and they do their best in order to keep them. You know, another good example of that, Mitchelton Scott. They are changing only four riders from this season to the following one. Whereas in Katusha, to say the first one that springs to my mind, it's every year 10 new signings, 10 riders out, 10 riders in. So, because clearly the team doesn't quite work and they need to shake the roster in order to see if some good comes in, you know, and to see if the spirits change a bit. By the way, that we are talking about signings, do you want some transfer talk on Dimension Data?
Very quickly.
So I hear that Eduard Prades, Spanish rider from Caja Rural, who won the Arctic Race of Norway this year and was pretty prominent in the Tour de Yorkshire, fighting with Greg Van Avermaet for the win, he might be heading there. It's not fully confirmed, but what I heard from sources within the Euskadi Murias team, because I said he was for Caja Rural, no, he was with Caja Rural in 2017, now he's with Euskadi Murias. What I heard from these sources is that he is indeed leaving to Dimension Data.
Interesting. Well, some sprinklers have just gone on watering the artificial football pitch here that we're sitting next to. That water is hopefully not going to come over in our direction, but nevertheless, I think that is it for stage five of the Vuelta. We will be back tomorrow, of course, Fran. And well, the face of Spain is going to change, I think, a bit more significantly over the next few days, particularly when we get inland. I mean, it's a part of the country that I really know nothing about. And you're abandoning me at the weekend, leaving me to my own devices. I just hope I make it. You know, it's going to be a nervous few days for me, that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the biggest change is that you are going to miss me a lot, Lionel. But, well, even with my expertise and my beauty by your side, I'm sure you will be able to carry on.
I will carry the spirit of the king of Spanish cycling with me on Saturday and Sunday. But you're still here for another couple of days. So until tomorrow, Fran, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lionel.